Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, January 27th, 2025. My name is Magnus Thiewald, and joining me
Peter,
in the studio.
Peter R.H.
And we have a bunch of good stuff lined up for you today. We have an interview with Sean Cranberry about the challenges the small press and writers sort of festival scene is having, not only here in Vancouver, but across the country. There's a lot of organizations are running into trouble. Some have shut down. Others are finding themselves in a bit of a cash crunch. It's a bit of a new world for that scene, which is a really important incubator for writers and the writers' community here in Vancouver and in Canada. So we're going to talk to Sean about that. We have a story from Danny, our reporter here at CJSF, about preparations and planning that the city of Burnaby is doing for extreme weather emergencies. We've, of course, with the big atmospheric river earlier this fall, we had quite a bit of flooding in Burnaby. And of course, they're also looking at things like wildfire risks, looking down at what's been happening down in Los Angeles. What are you talking about today, Peter?
Well, I'm going to talk about the history of mainland Chinese and the U.S. trade, starting in 1979, actually.
Right.
Because when Nixon went to China in 1972, there wasn't the beginning of trade. But there was, starting in 1979, a few years after Chairman Mao's death.
Right. And, of course, today there's a huge amount of trade between the U.S. And China. And one of the things Donald Trump has been talking a lot about is slapping a tariff on all that Chinese trade, anywhere from 10% to 60%. So it's kind of that history is relevant.
Yes. So it's sort of... It's interesting that it's really not till 1995 there's a perceived trade imbalance between the U.S. and mainland China. And prior to then, in the 1980s, until like the mid-1990s, it was the Japanese that they were concerned about. Mm-hmm. And that sort of kind of faded away. Unfortunately for Japan, in a sense that they sort of lost their way. I mean, I during the 1990s, they weren't as strong economically mm-hmm. as they had been prior to then.
Yep.
And so we're going to go through it.
Excellent. So, it's beautiful weather out there today. And we'll bring you some weather a little later in the broadcast. Plus, got a couple good tunes lined up for you as well. But let's get started off with Sean Cranberry, my discussion with Sean Cranberry, about what's been happening and the challenges facing the publishing and writing community across Canada. Sean is one of the leaders of and organizers of the Real Vancouver Writers Series, a regular series bringing local writers a forum to discuss their work and share their work, and has been very involved in the writing and publishing community, not only here in Vancouver, but through involvement in things like the Canada Council. We sat down last week to talk about some of the challenges being faced by that community. Welcome, Sean Cranberry. Thank you for joining me today.
Hey, Magnus, thanks for having me. It's great to be back on CJSF.
Great. Yeah, you have a bit of history with us, having in years past done a show on writing and publishing in our local community in that area.
Yeah. There was from 2009 to 2015. It was called Books on the Radio, and it was a lot of fun.
Great. Well, we're actually here to talk a bit more about that same subject today. Because you've been active, you know, with shows like that, but a lot of other things, active in the writing and publishing scene in Vancouver for many years, with projects like the Real Vancouver's Writers Festival, as well as an observer of the scene here in Vancouver and across the country. So you recently posted on social media to your many colleagues in the business about serious troubles grassroots organizations are facing these days. Maybe before we get into that, maybe you could just sort of give us a bit of your background in the area that sort of sets you up as a good observer of what's been happening.
Yeah, thanks. A lot of it started with Books on the Radio. In 2009, that was sort of pre-podcast economy, right? Like early days. And having that transition, I was experimenting with podcasts, but I was also literally on the radio and with you guys. And so it caught some attention for a lot of reasons. Around that time, the Olympics blew through town. I partnered with a group called W2, where you and I also have some relationship history there, and started this thing called the Real Vancouver Writer Series. It's been 15 years, obviously since 2010. So being in touch with putting writers in front of audiences, marketing, promoting, connecting with publishers and writers across the country, being involved in those conversations. Was involved as a steering committee for the Canada Council in 2013, 2014, to put together the National Forum on Literary Arts, which was this big transition in public funding from the old model to what's the new model today, which is where we have the portal, this thing called the portal on the Canada Council. Everybody who knows what I'm talking about is groaning and is in misery right now thinking about it. And a lot of work with the BC Arts Council, sitting on juries, advisories, being involved with writers, all kinds of stuff like that. And being involved and in conversation with these folks, especially on channels, on the social media channels, as they deteriorate before our very eyes, there's a lot of conversation about a lot of changes that are happening, whether it's related to funding or related to other things in the various industries that are attached to it.
Right. So what you were posting on the post that started this conversation between us, is that a lot of organizations, grassroots organizations, are finding themselves in trouble or facing a lot of challenges that are new. Can you kind of explain what you're talking about there?
Yeah. So, it's tough all over, as they say, right? So the day that I had posted that was the 14th, so about 10 days ago, and it was really around the announcement that New Star Books, sort of local, legendary, grassroots, anarchist publisher that has published some of the finest voices in Vancouver and Canadian literature in the past 50-some-odd years, right? They've decided to shut down, and that sort of piggybacked on Broken Pencil magazine also recently shutting the doors. Kingston Writers Series just cut bait and left town and hadn't paid a whole bunch of people money, and there's a lot of bad feelings around that. So Kingston Writers Fest has been around for a long time, always has a great reputation. Creative Writing and Publishing Program at Sheridan College is winding itself down. This is the last cohort that will graduate in that in the next couple of years, to my understanding. Word Vancouver, local, legendary, festival that happens at in its physical manifestation at the VPL in end of September every year. It has a shortfall, $25,000, a giant chunk of money that you just don't find in your couch. Mm-hmm. Lots of other organizations, Real Vancouver Writer Series, just, the one that I'm involved with, I'm most familiar with, has been shut down in our grant applications from various Canada Council and BC Arts Council over the past year. It's been a real struggle for us to to find that mix, other local organizations who chimed in on that thread as well. So the writing and publishing community, a lot of them in the grassroots area, seem to be saying that there's, for different reasons, the taps are being turned off on some of those situations, and each situation is different. You know, a book publisher is way different than a reading series. Yeah. But it does seem to me, you know, that these things are cyclical. I do think that, you know, when it comes to things like Real Vancouver, for example, you know, we're not a corporate, no one's getting paid, right? So everyone's doing this stuff as a volunteer. And after a certain point of time, we've been doing this for 15 years, you know, perhaps fatigue begins to set in, you know?
Yeah.
And I'd be the first to admit that, you know, we have to, as people who are applying for public money, we have to own a little bit of that part of the process ourselves. Yeah. But you know, it is happening not just here but elsewhere as well, and it is a bit of a trend that people are feeling.
So what do you think? You've sort of alluded to a few things. What do you think is sort of behind this? You know, is it a hangover from the pandemic? Is it, you know, the impact of social media, or is it this, you know?
You know, I don't know. Like, social media is such a weird thing. You can blame it for everything, and yet it helped so many other things. Mm-hmm. In many ways, it helped the writing community in Canada become better acquainted with itself. It broke down those traditional geographical boundaries. It put people directly in contact. You know, you didn't have to write a letter to the editor at the Walrus in order to be heard. And yet, obviously, we've seen that it's also hugely problematic. Mm-hmm. And you know, part of sort of this, like, modern corporate way of managing media. But I think that some part of it is the pandemic. I do think that when you're talking about book publishers that have been around for a little while and trying to pass that business, quite apart from the art and cultural aspect of it, it's the business, right? Mm-hmm. Passing that along to someone who's going to carry it into the future, where, you know, it's tough. It's tough to sell poetry the best time, and it's tough to find a market to sell. Where Indigo, Amazon, independent bookstores. How do you market and promote that stuff? It's tough, and you got to be really dedicated. I do think that there's a part of it which is that some arts organizations, we're talking about public funding, I do think that there are some that are the funders, the public funders, BC Arts Council, Canada Council, whomever, are changing, well, they're changing the algorithm. They're changing the way that the funding gets allocated, mm-hmm. right? So BC Arts Council has definitely gone further towards really, really trying to get out of the metropolitan region. So, you know, our organization is called Real Vancouver. It's tough. Yeah. We do try and be as diverse and sharing our platform as much as we can. But the BC Arts Council has gone towards, like, funding more regional stuff, getting out of the 604 area code, which I think is great. And they have absolutely focused more funding on Indigenous, rural and remote, traditionally underserved communities, which, again, you can't argue with. It's a great idea. So I think the models have shifted. Maybe the organizations have not, or maybe the organizations have only sort of paid lip service to mm-hmm. the transitions and maybe really haven't embodied it, and we're starting to see that now.
Yeah. So, I mean, from your thread, you know, a lot of people chimed in and participated with their own organized or their own experiences, sort of echoing what you were hearing. And from that, you sort of moved on to creating a forum on Discord where you could discuss it more, with an idea towards perhaps finding solutions, or at least identifying the problem more clearly so people could address it. So how's that discussion going?
It's going really well. So what we did is we started what's called the Discord server.
Yeah.
It's an independent spot on this on the internet that is managed within a framework of a thing called Discord, which mm-hmm. in some ways, just for the listeners who might not know, it sort of functions like your own private Twitter or Facebook account,
yeah.
Right? So, and you have to join it. You have to either be invited or you have to have a link in order to access it. And you, so your mom or your aunt or your uncle who's posting, you know, cat memes or what conspiracy theories yeah. is not on there, right? And so the 14th, right around the time when, you know, stuff is about to go haywire, the transition and the American political scene is happening. Elon Musk is Elon Musk. Like, there's a lot of concern on the social media channels that what was more than 10 years ago, 2013, 2014, this Valhalla of conversation and cat yeah. memes. And everything was great. Social media is awesome.
And really providing a great way to promote things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a different time, right? Mm-hmm. And so now poison is in the wound. Fascism is everywhere. It's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so where you could have these conversations, say on Facebook, say on Twitter, say wherever, in those old days, now you can still have those conversations, but somebody else in your feed is going to T-bone you with some like slogans or some
yeah.
theories or some crap or some ad or Temu or whatever, right?
Yeah.
It's just cluttered. So and people were concerned, especially about the fascism piece. So we were like, okay, well, let's just start our own community on Discord yeah. and let's just see if people are going to be interested in it. And, you know, it's been a little more than a week, and I think we've got like 100, 120 people who've just migrated there. We haven't promoted it, or it's all word of mouth, which I think is good. And the conversation inside is pretty engaged. People are talking about a lot of different things, and I think people are – what's happening is that they're happy to not have that crap
mm-hmm.
interrupt what it is that they want to talk about, which is books and writing, their favorite books, questions about editing and novels and manuscripts and all that kind of stuff. It for now, it's because you never want to say that anything's for forever, because you know social media just doesn't work that way. But for now, it's a nice solution for the problem of all of the noise
mm-hmm.
that accompanies conversations online now.
So you sort of described it perhaps as something that's cyclical. Do you think things are going to swing back for these organizations, or do they need to find some way to change?
You know, I think at some point you really do have to do some hard thinking about where you are as an organization. And I think that it doesn't matter doesn't matter who you are. You know, I'm sure, you know, CJSF, certainly at W2, we had to do some soul searching.
Yeah.
But I think that I for those organizations, I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
For the people who are involved in those organizations, who are learning and who are a part of it and who are seeing what's up, I think that part of the cycle and part of the problem, the general problem with, say, things like public funding for mm-hmm. art, is that there's this assumption that it will last forever.
Yeah.
And that there's an infinite amount of funds and that, you know, but part of that is problematic because so many sort of legacy arts organizations, right? Vancouver International Film Festival, Vancouver Writers Festival, Stratford in Ontario, for example.
Yeah.
They've been around for a long, long time and they are sort of like always going to get the money.
Yeah. And they often get quite a lot of funding.
And they're going to take a chunk, right? Yeah. So Real Vancouver is asking for a drop in the bucket. We didn't get it.
Yeah.
Fair enough. We're not asking for up to $250,000 in funding. It would be awesome, but that's not what we're asking for. So I think that, and the more important thing, that one of the things that we've talked with the BC Arts Council about a lot and Canada Council as well, is how do you honor the legacy arts organizations, make sure that, you know, they're still there. But how do you also make room for new entrants? You know, like where is the opportunity for kids coming out of SFU who've got great ideas, a ton of energy, but they need a little bit of money.
And I guess,
I know from experience, it's really tough to get in there. So, you know, maybe what's happening is that they're recognizing, maybe it's partly because of the pandemic. I don't know. but it might be that, you know, change is happening, yeah, and the churn is on, and that's just the way it is.
And maybe the question shouldn't be about these organizations, but rather the community of writers and publishers and everybody involved in that sort of community and ecosystem that, that provides a supportive place for art to happen.
Yeah, totally, totally, totally. So the organizations themselves might have to change, adapt or whatever, but I think that if the communities, the art, the literature, the writing, the publishing, all of that stuff is built into the fabric of our society, and it will survive and it will change. As long as all of that, as long as we're encouraging new entrants and we're encouraging organizations to change, I think there's no problem. It'll be fine. And one of the things that's very famous across all art forms is, you know, the process of handing a successful arts organization on to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter whether it's publishing, writing, art, blah, blah, blah. It's really hard. And the arts councils really try to work with some of these older folks who are, you know, who have done great work for decades, into transitioning to a newer generation. And it's really tough for them to do. I've heard them talk about it quite a bit.
Right, the founder syndrome.
Yeah.
Where, you know, someone who's built it up over decades even, you know, it's hard to step away and let someone else take over.
Yeah, yeah, conflict of ideas, sort of generational conflict of how to go about doing things, and just the brutal reality of the economy right now. Yeah. It doesn't help either, you know?
So I want to help, you know, put this into perspective a little bit of just how important this community can be. So what is the role of small presses and local festivals and those kind of things? Because we hear a lot about, you know, the Giller Prize and the big festivals and, you know, all that really high profile stuff. But, you know, that's operating way up here where people have made it already. What is the role of the small presses and the local festivals and that whole community? What does it mean for writing in Canada?
Yeah, I mean, it's the grassroots. It's where it all starts, you know. It's incredibly rare for somebody's very first book, an unknown person, to, like, float its way up to the Giller shortlist and win that thing, which is $100,000, you know, and guaranteed sales and book deals and blah, blah, blah. So the small presses are super important, and Vancouver has some of the best. I mean, New Star is shutting down, but New Star is a really important local press. Obviously, Arsenal Pulp Press and Anvil Press, not all the presses begin with A, but they are super important because they have their own personal mandate to focus on art and to focus on stories that matter. And they have the ability to experiment with stylistic change, new voices. I mean, the LGBTQ 2S+ community that is served by folks like Arsenal, like the work that those folks, those books have found huge audiences that they never would have found had they been published. Well, Random House or HarperCollins never would have published them.
Right.
They would have just left them in the slush stack, you know? So, you know, you're not going to sell a lot necessarily with a small press. But, you know, like a lot of these small presses, that whether they're publishing, you know, feminist work, poetry, nonfiction, very specific stuff, there is still a grassroots community that attends that stuff, and the big people are paying attention to it. The Random Houses, the Harpers, they're all paying attention. Social media makes it a lot easier. Things like Real Vancouver, I mean, we give people a place to gather four times a year and to meet writers, and writers get to see an audience and have their books promoted, supported, and seen. And I think that as a gathering spot, you know, most of our local stuff that we've done over the past couple of years has been done at the Russian Hall, which is just down Strathcona neighborhood, just off Hastings and Hawks. And so close for people to gather, places to eat and drink around. It's just really important for people to see each other, especially post-pandemic, right? Like to get together in the same room with people of talent that, you know, you might meet somebody, you might see something, you might feel part of a scene. really important. And things like the festival, I may have sounded like I was hacking on Vancouver Writers Festival earlier, but I am not, because one of the things that they do is they not only platform local writers in conversation with like famous international writers, but they bring those folks from around the country and around the world into Vancouver to give audiences and local writers the opportunity to rub shoulders and be on the same level. You know, I think Vancouver has some of the tightest and best writers in the world working today. Yeah. And I really think that, you know, that it's a result of a really strong grassroots publishing and writing community that that punches above its weight and doesn't get the credit that perhaps it's due. But I think you ask anybody around, and they'll tell you that the Pacific Northwest, Portland, Seattle, Vancouver, it's one of these like hidden secrets of literature in North America. People love it.
Great. Well, you know, I guess we live in pretty weird times right now. I mean, just this week is pretty weird already. You know, hopefully the community will see itself rebound and move on to new strength.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, like what you guys are doing too, CJSF, is a really important part of the fabric of what we're talking about. Writers tend to, and publishers, they tend to sort of second themselves among each other.
Yeah.
And that we do better when we connect with other art forms and other media opportunities, and the local stuff that you guys are doing is a big, important part of making sure that the community stays in touch with each other and feels seen. So thank you for the work that you guys are doing.
Thank you. So, with your new Discord community, is there a way people can get a hold of you? I know the invite link is kind of too complicated to read out on the air here. Nobody's going to get it. You know, yeah. Can they reach out to you via one of your platforms?
Yeah, so you can they can reach out just by email. Probably the easiest.
Yeah.
So Real Vancouver Writer Series, we have our URL is realvancouver.org.
Yeah.
And so just put Sean at the beginning of that, Sean at realvancouver.org, S-E-A-N, yeah. And send me an email and I will fire you off the link.
Great. So if you want to join and get be part of this community, talking about what's going on in Vancouver, both in terms of, I guess, ongoing events and community and collaboration, but also, you know, discussing the health of the community, follow up with Sean there. Thanks so much for talking to me today, Sean. Sean Cranberry of Real Vancouver Writer Series and many other activities in the community. Thanks for coming and talking about this these challenging times today.
Yeah, thanks, Magnus. Great to see you.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Yep.
And that was Sean Cranberry of the Real Vancouver Writers Series. And that email, again, if you're curious about getting involved with that conversation, which is taking place on a Discord Discord server featuring many folks from our area and beyond, you know, talking about what's happening in the writing and publishing scene and what solutions might be brought forth to reinvigorate that scene and make it healthy. And that is Sean at realvancouver.org, S-E-A-N for Sean at realvancouver.org. And send him a note. Tell him you're interested in joining the conversation, and he'll hook you up. All right. We have coming up in just a couple of moments, we have preparations that the City of Burnaby is making for extreme weather and how the community can manage that. But first we have, here is Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Christian Cooper is host of the National Geographic show Extraordinary Birder, and author of the memoir Better Living Through Birding. But as a kid, Christian says he wasn't interested in birds until his parents made him take a woodshop class.
I had to build something, so I built a bird feeder and I put it up in the backyard.
Christian filled the feeder with cracked corn. And then
this bird shows up, all black except for this patch of red at the wings.
At first, Christian thought he discovered a new species of crow.
And I was thrilled with my preteen scientific prowess. And then I found out it was a red-winged blackbird. Oops. But still, to this day, one of my favorite birds, and they are the first sign of spring for me. Because growing up on Long Island, they would all depart en masse. And I would get mildly depressed in the course of the winter. And then I would hear sometime in like March, okay. And I'd be like, they're back. They're back. Thank God they're back. Spring is here.
Before we know it, spring will be with us again. For Bird Note, I'm Joanie Franklin.
Do you get that excited when you hear the birds come back in the spring?
I don't. You know, I think more dangerous is that it's the crows with their nests. Yes. Because actually, I'm right beside Loheed Mall, and yeah. I think there are that line of trees that they.
Right.
I'm right beside a primary school. I think there's.
You're like by one of those trees that all the birds come in the great freeway. They're heading for, every evening. They're heading, and they end up near your place.
No, not particularly. It's just that if it's only just one couple of crows, because it does take two to make a nest, you know,
yeah.
that they can cause havoc. Like they can chase you. Like I used to bounce a ball with a tennis racket down the street, and if it goes high up, they think you're trying to attack them, and yeah. it's kind of bad for that primary school that I'm.
Yeah, they come swooping down on you.
So I think we should do a trade embargo on Bird Note.
If no American bird stories?
Yeah, that's right. If we get only our Canadian bird or Vancouver area, because I think then it makes it, you know, I don't even know where this Long Island bird is. I don't know where it is. I mean, so I just so we can be relating to what's being said. So only the Canadian bird, or the British Columbia, because it's also, I'm talking about interacting, like an Ontario bird, maybe Doug Ford, oh, like that, but anyway.
All right.
How important is this station to you? Local radio, by and for your community, news and information that matters to you. You won't find anything like it anywhere else. Now we need you. We need your voice to support the Community Radio Initiative. You see, radio has been there for you in those important moments, and now we need your voice. You can join the fight for the future of community radio at mycri.ca, because local voices are what shapes our community.
On January 14th, 2025, Burnaby City Council passed a motion that directed city staff to plan for and mitigate the risk of extreme weather events, such as flooding and wildfire, in the Burnaby Official Community Plan that is currently being developed. While this is a decision that was made with the recent Los Angeles wildfires in mind, according to City Council, the planning for this decision had been months in the making. To learn more about what the planning and mitigation of extreme weather events in Burnaby would look like, CJSF sat down for an interview with one of the leaders of this motion, Burnaby City Councilor Allison Gu. During the interview, we asked Councilor Gu to expand on the planning and mitigation methods that the city hopes to implement, as well as the areas in Burnaby that are at highest risk if an extreme weather event were to occur. Please take a listen.
So the official community plan is every municipality's blueprint for the next 20, 25 years. So Burnaby 2050 is the name of our next official community plan. It designates the land uses and the densities of those uses for every parcel of land in the city. So it's a really powerful planning tool that municipalities have. The provincial government just changed legislation that essentially says that the official community plan has more power than previously it used to. And so it's a really important way to be able to set priorities for the future. And this motion was directing staff to make sure that we're mapping out where regional hazards are happening or are likely to happen because of climate change, such as wildfire and flooding, and look at how we can make sure that we're layering on appropriate land uses and appropriate densities where those hazards are going to occur.
And to expand on that a bit, I noticed that one of the locations that was specifically cited in the motion was Burnaby Mountain and the University and SFU community. What about Burnaby Mountain and SFU kind of make it a unique area that needs to be specifically addressed when considering climate emergencies?
Mm-hmm. So Burnaby Mountain, of course, is a very large forested area. It's designated as park. It is what we call the urban wildland interface, or the wildland urban interface, also known as the WUI. And when you have such close uses together, so you've got residential, you've got a dense amount of people, and you've got a dense amount of forest, as the threat of wildfire increases because of climate change, because of drier summers, because of a lack of proper forest management for decades, that means that you're exposing a lot more people to the risk of forest fire. And because the way that we build housing, the way that we have materials that are produced, mass consumption, there's just a lot more flammable materials now than what we manufactured, 40, 50 years ago. So the average living room will combust much quicker, like several minutes quicker than the average living room would have in the 1950s and 60s. And that's because the furniture that we create, it's a lot of, paper, cardboard, wood, put together with a bunch of plastic and glue. And that kind of stuff just ignites quicker. And so when you have these intersecting risks, they amplify each other. In respect to Burnaby Mountain, the risk further is amplified because of the TMX tank farm, of course, the Trans Mountain tank farm, and the amount, the quantity, the volume of extremely flammable liquid of oil petroleum product is further amplified by the risk of wildfire potentially spreading and igniting one of these tanks, and inversely, the risk of a human error or mechanical error creating a fire that starts at the tank farm and then spreads towards Burnaby Mountain.
You mentioned the pipeline there. I think maybe I could see one critique people having with a plan such as this, despite the fact that, making sure there is preparation in place for climate emergencies is extremely important. There are still, factors in regards to why this planning is the reason that the planning is being put forward, is because of the increased prevalence of these climate emergencies due to, ever persisting climate change. Is there plans in the OCP to also, address more overarching systemic issues that sort of contribute to these increased climate emergencies?
Yeah. So unfortunately, with those types of, structures, they, one, are at a different level of government. So the city of Burnaby was in staunch opposition to the pipeline and the expansion of the project all the way through. But the federal government has jurisdiction over that and can override our powers. So we're limited in that sense. And then there's also limitations in terms of certain types of uses that are established grandfathered in uses. So we know that there's existing institutional refinery right alongside the shores. We know that there's the Trans Mountain Expansion Pipeline. The OCP changing that wouldn't change those uses immediately. So even if I was to say, this is a parcel of land that's a house right now, and I want it to be park or school in the future, when I designate that through the OCP, it essentially signals to the future what that will become. But it doesn't mean that the city of Burnaby is going to come and expand expropriate that land immediately. It doesn't mean any of that. And it doesn't necessarily at all change the market value of that house, especially if that land is going to be converted to a government ownership. They'll pay market price. So the OCP, really, what it is important in changing is whether a property gets upzoned. And that upzoning is really kind of looking at how many more times people can live in this parcel of land. And what I'm saying is that, you know, that it's a very complicated process to be buying up properties that we know are at risk. They refer to that as managed retreat. This motion doesn't even call to that because we know we have a lot of questions to answer before we can realistically start to embark on those types of endeavors, such as funding. So what it's saying really is we shouldn't exacerbate the problem by putting a ton of people in an area that we know we're going to expose them to wildfire, flooding, other types of climate change induced hazards, and to take precautions in our kind of conflicting goals, because we have conflicting goals. We have a housing crisis. So we know we need to build more housing. We know we need to build dense housing. We know we need to build them in areas that are close to SkyTrain and transit. So how do we manage all of these conflicting tensions? Right now, thus far, we haven't necessarily put a language or addressed that tension and to kind of consider and balance those tensions, because we know in order to meet our housing goals, if we don't build, you know, extra density in a specific area, then we know we're going to have to redistribute those housing units, those planned housing units elsewhere throughout the city. So how can we better plan for that? And where we can't redistribute those densities, how do we better create design standards that are required in new buildings so that people aren't exposed to undue risk for their property or for themselves? One example of that is for flooding. Historically, most, you know, high-rise buildings, larger buildings, they have their electrical units concentrated in the basements. And if we plan for, you know, a tower that is going to be in an area that floods, for example, the Still Creek area, right near Gilmore SkyTrain Station, we know that those basements are likely going to flood. So we need to be creating requirements for that electrical equipment to be moved to the second floor or the third floor, and to look at ways that we can protect people, especially people whose you know, safety and like livelihood relies on the operation of electrical equipment.
Once again, that was CJSF in conversation with Burnaby City Councilor Allison Gu on the recent motion that was passed to direct city staff to plan for and mitigate the risk of extreme weather events in Burnaby. Thank you so much for listening to this piece. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This piece would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also listen to this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday, you heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
Coming up this afternoon at 3 o'clock, Peter.
Yes, so I'm going to talk about the history of the United States trade with mainland China, starting in 1979. Now, what kind of precipitated this was Nixon's, he did diplomatic relations in 1972 with Henry Kissinger. Which was sort of, they were trying to do, you know, because they were trying to, I guess, have the Marxist regime of China help deal with the Soviet Union. I guess that was sort of the...
And of course, And prior to that, there hadn't been any formal diplomatic relations between the communist regime on the mainland and the United States, since, even though the communists had taken over mainland China in 1950.
You brought up a very important point. I forgot about that. Was when they reversed it, instead of having Taiwan being a member of the UN and mainland China not being it, it was turned the other way around because of that trip.
Right. And basically a recognition of reality that, there are still two Chinas, China and Taiwan, but the communist regime on the mainland represented the vast, essentially the bulk of China.
Well, part of the issues that come when you get such an more of an alignment is that human rights in mainland China and so on. I mean, it was sort of their choice in 1972 to reverse it. I mean, but the Taiwan country really didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
It seems kind of unfair in that way. What kind of precipitated was this ping pong tournament in 1971, actually? So that, but Chairman Mao died in 1976. And so there was really no trade relations until 1979. And actually, on the Council on Foreign Relations, which I'm a bit critical of the organization, they actually were for the second Iraqi war, just to point out. But they do have an interesting timeline for me to go through. The 1979 was the beginning, but it's funny that they are in their timeline. They say mainly that there was Taiwan relations and so on. So it was sort of like an incidental thing, actually, that it just incidentally started under Jimmy Carter. Now, this is a really odd one. For 1982, they say Ronald Reagan visits China in April 1984, and in June, the U.S. government permits Beijing to make purchases of U.S. military equipment. Now, that's a bit of an odd bit odd. For Tiananmen Square, in response, the U.S. government suspends military sales to Beijing and freezes relations. Now, under Clinton, it, of course, resumes trade. In fact, we really don't get a trade imbalance till like the mid-1990s, 1995. What was the concern previously? What was the Japanese?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of surprisingly enough, the Jap during the 1980s, that was the real fear. In fact, it was trade with mainland China was kind of white noise in many ways.
There's a real sort of all the angst was about how well the Japanese were doing in terms of trading. You know, I guess in general, but also in terms of particularly trading to the United States and the way that the Japanese, for instance, in the car industry had gone from very small in the 60s to nearly dominant in the, not dominant, but a huge chunk of market in the by the 1980s.
Well, okay, I'm going to get on my tablet. I got during the 80s or... There was a very huge tariff placed on Japanese cars, actually, mm-hmm. and I'll get that specific thing later. But I want to have my tablet on this because in the year 2000, President Clinton signed the U.S.-China Relations Act of 2000 in October, granting Beijing permanent normal trade relations with the United States and paving the way for China to join the World Trade Organization in 2001. Between 1980 and 2004, U.S. trade rises from $5 billion to $231 billion. In 2006, China surpasses Mexico as the United States' second biggest trading partner after Canada. So that's sort of the beginning of it. One mm-hmm. thing that was sort of Bill Myers, he's sort of with a PBS guy, right. the guy that interviewed Joseph Campbell and all this.
Yeah.
I saw something quite a while ago, maybe like 20 years ago, that they were talking about like how to have a resurgence, economic resurgence in the United States. They're saying like part of the problem was that in the 1930s, if you just give the average citizen money, that they'll automatically, all that goes to American goods. It sort of stimulates that. And they mm-hmm. now, how true that was, I don't know. I mean, they were saying, well, then if you do for consumers, you give consumers money or, you know, government money or whatever it means, then it doesn't automatically mean that it's going to go to American manufacturing jobs, which right, was the argument.
You know, a certain amount of any consumer goods are now manufactured overseas and then imported.
Well, what I'm finding is actually, and I think last week Stephen Fan was bringing up a few points that mainland China now is farming off a lot of the, like you go to Walmart, you get it from Bangladesh, a T-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And so his argument last week, well, I mean, he was presenting a few facts that it's, They're stepping up on their high tech, I guess mm-hmm. they said, for medical things. So that's been I got here some of the Japanese things. Oops. Anyway, oh, I get it. Okay, so, but. Oh, like I think there was one point in the 1980s, every VCR was made in Japan. I don't think had you heard that previously, Magnus? That the technology?
Yeah, well, I know that you know at one time, for example, there was a robust American industry in like televisions, for example. Televisions were manufactured in the United States. Whereas nowadays, I don't think any televisions are made in the United States. And there's other products like that, too. I think maybe like freezers and things like that and some other, and maybe refrigerators. But, you know, there are certain whole product classes that aren't even made in the United States. TVs are definitely one of them. And a bunch of others. You know, so when we get this talk of tariffs and stuff, you know, tariffs only work if you have some local production that can fill that gap. But when it comes to things like televisions or, you know, kitchen appliances and things like that, all those tariffs are going to do is raise prices for American consumers.
Oh, here's the exact yep. number I got. Restraints on Japanese autos were equivalent to a tariff rate of exceeding 60%. So that was during the 1980s.
Right.
So it makes me wonder why anybody got a Japanese car in the United States during that time.
Well, I guess part of the issue is that they were much more efficient in their manufacturing. So maybe they were cheaper and better value for a time. I think America, you know, the big American automakers have closed that gap. But now they're facing a similar challenge from Chinese automakers. And I believe here in Canada we have a huge, and the United States and some other Western countries, we have a huge tariff on Chinese electric vehicles because they're so cheap.
Well, did you know that during that period, did Canada have the same tariffs on Japanese cars as the United States? Maybe we had more Japanese cars during that era.
That I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised just because that might have, you know, you know, I mean, between AutoPac prior to NAFTA and then NAFTA and then the more recent agreement, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes into making an integrated automobile industry where you know, automobile parts and cars and everything just moves across the border freely without any real restraint so that the...
Until this idiot.
Yeah, until these
because
threats.
It's going to be stupidity because it's like how supposedly how a car is produced between the United States and Canada at this time. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Hopefully there'll be no, he won't have the legality to do it. But what I read was something, it was only four pages. It was a research on the trade imbalance between China and the United States. Now, this was from The Department of School, it was from the North China University of Technology in Beijing, China. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they bring up is that they would like their currency to be more accepted worldwide, it seemed. It seemed like they were contending in that paper, which is coming from their point of view, that they have a low currency, and that is basically the reason why there is a trade imbalance. And they were sort of – I think that there's actually one thing about what the colloquial term, the petrodollar, mm-hmm. what it really is, and this is what it specifically is. Every OPEC country – can only accept American currency for its petroleum. It cannot accept gold. It cannot accept other currency. It cannot accept sheep or cattle. Yeah. That is the only thing it can accept, which, of course, backs up the American dollar. Yeah. And that's not the only commodity, supposedly, that there are agreements about worldwide. Oh, the other thing, I wanted to bring this up last week. When you heard about the Washington you don't hear about the Washington consensus, mm-hmm. but
which
what
was?
What it specifically is the idea that the Federal Reserve and the offices of the World Bank, the United Nations World Bank, the United Nations International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C., are basically backing up the American dollar because the Federal Reserve is basically it's not quite a conspiracy. I mean, there's a lot to say a backup. And actually, when it was presented in the 1990s, the Battle of Seattle and later.
Yep.
They even had a demonstration against the World Bank and the IMF in 2000. That concept was that, people say it's not part of the United Nations, but it's part of the actual system, the United Nations system, the World Bank, the IMF, that basically the Federal Reserve was in conjunction with it. And it was protection of the American dollar. Now, this paper, which it was sort of saying that their argument was that this would solve more problems if the currency of mainland China was more used, and they were saying that would perhaps help out with the trade imbalance and help both sides.
I know it's not an issue I've heard for a few years, but there used to be a lot of complaints about that the Chinese were sort of artificially keeping their currency low, which reduced the prices of their products relative to the American dollar. I haven't really heard that complaint for a few years, but that sort of...
Well, I just got it kind of randomly, but it is from...
Yeah.
It's in the English language.
Yep.
But they... what was interesting... I guess it's a pretty low-level report, but it's saying that they feel that they, and from their point of view, or the author's point of view, they would have liked the more prominence of the because you really can't use it. I mean, they use it themselves, but they want to international.
We don't have time to talk about it today, but it'd be an interesting thing to look into. Maybe we'll talk about this in a future program. Just what benefits that gives the United States and would give China to be, you know, to be that international currency, right? That currency everyone's trading in. Because I've heard how it does, in fact, sort of confer significant benefits on the United States in terms of their freedom of movement. But unfortunately, we only have a minute left in the show, so we don't have time to dig into that. But it's sort of an interesting thing in perspective of that, because if China became a much more prominent currency of international trade...
Well, it's also the human rights aspect about that. But I did read that paper, and that was their perspective of the paper on that.
All right. Well, thanks for that today, Peter. China, trade with China. you know, which has gone from, and, you know, with the United States, but in the West, from nearly, from very small numbers around 1980 to, of course, today, where China is one of the dominant trading nations in the international community. Coming up soon, coming up in about 15 seconds, is Democracy Now! Stay tuned for Wandering Rhythms at noon and Typically Tuesday up at 3 o'clock. Thanks, Peter.
Okay.
We'll see you all next week. Yes. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!